You're tuned into PageCast. My name is Twanja Kalila. I am a media and communications professional, and I'm a big lover of books. And today we're joined by Tara Roos, who you've probably heard on Cape Talk or you've read her work in The Business Day. And now she's added debut author to the list with her new book, Where To From Here, Populism and Coalition Politics in South Africa. And then during the day, Tara is a political analyst and writer, and she's dipping her toes in the journalism field as well. So it's so good to have you with us to talk about your new book.
Thank you so much. I'm excited.
So before we get started and dive into the book, I just wanted to find out how you fell in love with politics. You don't hear or meet a lot of young people your age who absolutely just live, breathe and eat it, you know?
So I grew up in a Cape Talk household. We only listened to talk radio. It was no KFM, no music at all. And I mean, I grew up in the peak of the Zuma years. So there was like a deep dive into politics and the politics of South Africa. Like I remember my dad driving me to school every morning and he would quiz me, like, who's the deputy president? Who's the minister of finance? In the Zuma era, the answer you gave yesterday was not the same answer there was today. I loved politics. I mean, in high school, I was super involved. I joined this club called Current Affairs, where every Tuesday we got together in the seminar room and all we did was spoke about the news. And I've been in love with politics and just South Africa at large my entire life. And it's something that stayed with me. And I think that's how I fell in love with journalism as well. Like I remember in high school, I mean, all I spoke about was the news and the state of the world. And during lunch, my friends would be like, you only have 5 minutes to update us about what is happening in the world.
And then you need to lighten up and focus on other things. And it's so interesting that you mentioned that, because I realized as I was reading the introduction of your book that as South Africans, we've been through so much. In the intro, you kind of list what we've been through in the last 10 years alone. And there were names like Oscar Pistorius, Senzo Meyiwa, Nkandla and Zondo. And it's really overwhelming. Was that kind of what led to you deciding to write this book and just kind of look at where we are and take stock of how we got here?
I think especially like having almost my political awakening in the Zuma years, so much was happening. And I vividly remember 2014 and everyone being like, what is going on? State capture. We've never seen this before. Because the Thabo Mbeki years were relatively quiet.
Yeah.
And it was that almost sense in 2014 of being like, things can't get worse than it is now. And clearly, things have evolved and gotten a lot worse.
Yeah.
And it was really that political realization I had growing up to say that the country is drastically changing and we as the citizens are also drastically changing. And I think it's, you know, over the years, specifically in that 2014, 2015, 2016 period, people were so politically aware about what was happening inside the world. And it was across generations. But I think we've almost lost that political astuteness as the South African public. Yeah. And that was really my big motivation behind writing this book.
And it's so interesting because I've seen a lot of people disengage from it. I think it does become overwhelming. And what you've done is you've written a book, I call it in three acts. You kind of look at the first part of our democracy in the first part. Then you try to really understand the 2024 elections, which I think was a huge turning point. And then you try to tackle this huge question of where we are now. And I wanted to know why you think South Africans are really disengaging. What do you think was that turning point? Because we kind of saw it in the 2024 results, but it must have happened before that, right?
I think there is a culmination of factors that led to the disengagement of the South African voter. And I think South Africans are just tired. And that's what I think it ultimately comes down to is that, you know, the dawn of democracy was this big promise about who we were as a nation, about where we were going as a country. And those promises haven't been fulfilled. Yeah. Today, many South Africans find themselves in the exact same position they did pre-1994. And it is really to everyone in society. You know, I talk about this in the book, about how there's this almost like blame game that we
play. Yeah.
Politicians will blame the voters and they will say, people are not engaged. People don't actually pay attention to politics and they're not listening. Voters will then turn and be like, the media isn't reporting on all of these stories. What the media bias? Why isn't the media focusing on this? And then the media will turn to both the voters and the politicians and being like, actually, it's your fault for not reading the news. And it's your fault for not being truthful to the South African public. And, you know, it's this revolving door of blame. And I think what I really want to do in this book is for us to be honest with ourselves about where we are as a country, where we are going as a country, and what is the priority for South Africa to solve as a nation. Because pre-1994, the goal was democracy.
Yeah.
Post-1994, we had this idea of unification and who we were as a country and the national identity of the country. And we had a vision about where we're going. And I think we've lost that. And
absolutely,
that's the question I think we need to solve for now.
Absolutely. And then before we delve into it, because party politics is obviously the key theme throughout the book and it's dominated it. One thing that I found quite fascinating was that in South Africa, and I guess it's because we come from a struggle background, that personalities in politics tend to dominate the headlines. It's Malema, it's Zuma, it's Zilla, you know, all these big names where Ramaphosa thrown around. But it struck me that you focused less on the individual and the personalities and more on the parties. What led to that decision?
I think populism in the rise of personality politics is a result of a disengaged electorate. Mm. But ultimately, I mean, these parties are massive engines and machinery in the political zeitgeist of South Africa. Yeah. And the way that in which these parties operate, it's really key for you to understand the political operation in order to understand the political landscape at large and the role that every single person in a party plays. I mean, you know, we look at politicians as these big personalities and big identities. Behind a politician, there is a personal assistant and a speechwriter and a researcher. Mm. There are so many different people that go up into making a politician and its political identity. And I think the same goes for these political parties. And the reason why I think it's so important to focus on political parties is because political parties in South Africa, they're broad churches.
Yeah.
You know, they are in the DA. They say they are classically liberal and they are for liberal ideas. There are socialists who vote for the DA, who work in the DA. And it's the same thing across the ANC, across the EFF. And so this idea that political parties are broad churches, but South Africans aren't. And that in South Africa, voters vote on a very particular set of ideals, a very particular set of policy points, what they believe to be true of these political parties. But these political parties are so much more than what they tell you. Mm. And I think it's very important for us to understand that in order to really assess where South Africa is.
The one thing that really struck me was that voter turnout is dwindling. And then when you look at our politicians, most of them are of pensionable age, or at least the leading politicians. Yeah. And we aren't seeing a new crop of young leaders come up and make an impact. Why do you think that is? Is there a vacuum, or are they in the background and are we just not hearing from them? Because pre-2024, or I guess in the Zuma years, the youth league movements were so important, and we kind of knew who the players were, and that hasn't kind of continued.
There is a large disengagement, particularly with the youth vote, and I do think that there are certain young people, specifically within these political parties or in the background, who are trying to make their way up slowly and surely, but it's not in the same volume that we saw in the early 2000s and in the early 2010s. And I think that's for a particular reason. Young South Africans, and it's a big critique that I make in the book, is that, you know, people want perfect politics.
Yes.
They want a political party that they absolutely align with on every single policy position, on every single policy point. You know, they want perfect politicians that absolutely does not exist. There are fault lines with every politician, every political party. And I think because we have personalized politics and are searching for this perfection, it has resulted in the mass disengagement that you see. And that's why I think that young South Africans are so disengaged from politics, because people put the question out to say, why should I vote? You know, my vote doesn't matter. Statistically speaking, there are millions of South Africans who are casting their ballots, and why does my one vote matter? And, you know, and then 11 million people say that. Yeah. And then you have in the last election. It could have changed the results.
And then, I mean, the thing is that the party that wins is ultimately the party that convinces voters to come out to their numbers that year, you know, ultimately. And it's so interesting that you mentioned that people have kind of disengaged, because, and a huge reason, I remember 10 years ago, you wouldn't have been of voting age 10 years ago, unfortunately. I definitely was. A lot of people didn't vote because they said the ANC is going to win. We all know the outcome. And then this time, the ANC didn't. And for people who follow politics, it's a really exciting time. But I'd like us to kind of use that as a turning point to kind of delve into the individual parties and where they are. And if we look at the ANC, many people say this vote was a referendum on Cyril's leadership or, you know, on the ANC. But for the ANC, it's a huge machine. It's got huge organizational structures, and it experienced, I mean, we expected a decline, but not a rapid decline. What do you think led to it finding itself there?
You know, I think it was a combination of factors. We had the nine wasted years of Jacob Zuma. Cyril Ramaphosa came in 2019, and he campaigned of the city year of Tumamina. Send me. He's going to bring this age of renewal. And we haven't seen renewal. And there, you know, there are many factors that have resulted into where we are, specifically from a socioeconomic position. I mean, we went through a pandemic. There's been a global recession. There are wars raging all over the world that drastically affect South Africa. And those factors are out of the president's control. But also, there wasn't a change inside the ANC. And I think that is the big difference. You know, state capture was a massive moment in this country. And while there was a reckoning for the South African people, there wasn't a reckoning inside the ANC. And the biggest critique I make of the ANC, specifically in this book, is that the ANC is not honest with themselves.
Yeah.
You know, and we, and it brings up the question, when will the ANC be honest with themselves? Yeah. When they lost Cape Town, it was a the first indication we saw of the ANC's decline in governance. Because, I mean, Cape Town, out of all of the metros in South Africa, has the largest stable infrastructure and had the biggest infrastructure history out of all of the metros. The ANC just had to build on what was already in Cape Town. They were unable to do that. They lost that to the Democratic Alliance. Now we saw them lose in 2024 again. I mean, they dropped below 50. They lost the majority. They've lost the city of Joburg. The ANC's losses, specifically from a government sector, and it hasn't changed anything about the party. And the difficulty is that if you speak to any ANC top official now, and they were like, the ANC is doing fine. And that's the difficulty, is that they're not honest with themselves about, yes, while they have liberated South Africa, while they have played a massive part in where we are today in terms of our democracy, and they've given a lot, these various leaders of these political parties, specifically within the ANC, they've also taken a lot from South Africa. And I think the difficulty is that they're not honest about that. And that has led to the rapid ANC decline, because we almost, inside the ANC, there's this mentality of justification that, you know what, we are doing good. But, so the good outweighs and offsets the bad that is being done in the background. And for many South Africans, they cannot stick with that justification anymore.
And another aspect that many would argue that we aren't being honest about, or perhaps the ANC are not being honest about, is the rise and the threat of MK, which, if everybody's honest, no one saw it coming at the scale at which it did. I mean, the MK basically dominated the KZN, completely disrupted politics in many provinces. Why do you think that they were kind of primed, it was a prime time for them to do so? And how do you see their future in kind of government, particularly as this will be the first kind of local government elections that they kind of contest at a mass scale?
I think, you know, MK is just another faction of the ANC. Those are disengaged and frustrated ANC voters who reminisce on the Zuma era, not for President Jacob Zuma himself, but for the state South Africa was in under Zuma. You know, it was a better time, speaking economically. Petrol was lower. The cost of living was lower. And I think people long for that. And they associate the economic state of the country at the time with President Zuma. And I think what a lot of South Africans don't realize is that we're actually living in the economic reality of the decisions made by President Jacob Zuma. With MK at large, I mean, I talk about this in the book. I think that MK within itself, in its current structure, is destined to fail because they do not have any political structures. It is just the Zuma family with President Jacob Zuma at the helm making decisions without any formalized decisions. And that is not how you govern a country. You know, President Jacob Zuma now will say, XYZ person is fired, XYZ person is reinstated. And you can't run a country like that. And that's the difficulty, is that the governance model in which MK rules the party cannot be adopted to the country. And President Jacob Zuma is getting very old. And if anything were to happen to him, I do think that the party does not have enough internal political structures to move forward. And when we look at, I like to call the ANC governing bloc, the ANC, the EFF, and MK, that's relatively around 60%. That is still the ANC. And so while the ANC has broken up into these factions, the ANC voting bloc is still the same, which has shown that very little has actually changed about the South African electorate from 1994 up until now.
The EFF is fascinating to me because you brought them up, and it was a great growth story leading up to the 2024 elections. And then some people will argue that it is MK who kind of like snatched a few of their votes and their constituency. But we've also seen Malema's personal legal troubles kind of derail. We've seen lots of people defect and that kind of party kind of crumble. And it seems like it's similar to the MK and this kind of Zuma kind of structure. Where do you see the EFF going forward, you know?
The EFF, and the difficulty of the EFF is, and I said this in the book, is that the EFF's problem is that their voters age out of voting for the EFF. The EFF has a massive dominance, specifically amongst the youth vote, specifically at universities and TVET colleges, because of the residence structures and how they're able to play their influence there. But the difficulty of the EFF is that they haven't been able to properly articulate their principles and values to the South African majority.
Yeah.
You know, their policies are very leftist, very revolutionary forward, but they haven't been able to translate that into the places that they've governed in their specific municipalities. I mean, there are many unfulfilled promises of the EFF, and that's the difficulty, is that because unlike the DA, where they haven't been able to govern outright, the EFF has really relied on coalitions in order to use that as evidence of their governance. I mean, there was a school in 2019 where EFF President Judith Minerva said, you know, if we don't build the school, don't vote for us in the national election, the school isn't built today. And it's issues like that where the EFF hasn't been able to translate what they truly believe into governance practices. You know, many young people vote for the EFF when they're at university, and then they leave university and they get a job and they're like, oh, I have to pay tax and own a house and have kids and pay medical aid.
All these ideals that I was sold to haven't come true.
And that's the difficulty of the EFF, is that they put this very communal, almost communist forward ideals as their principles. But it's very difficult for young South Africans particularly to see themselves, you know, being a revolutionary while having to be in the capitalist South African landscape.
Yeah.
And that is the difficulty, is that the EFF hasn't really been able to communicate that change to their voters. And that's why people age out of voting for the EFF.
And the one, another party that kind of stagnated, arguably, is the DA. They've positioned themselves for the last kind of decade plus as the government in waiting, and they're governing now. Yeah. They got into it. But when you actually look at the election results, the growth wasn't what they anticipated, or what they told the electorate that we were likely to get. Why do you think that happened? Why do you think they stuck?
The DA, and the one thing the DA does well, is that they're amazing at communication. Their PR and communication strategy is completely out of this world. And if you take the DA's communication that they put forward at face value, you would think that the DA is doing absolutely amazing.
Absolutely.
The numbers tell us something completely.
If you log online, you'll see Helen Zille swimming in potholes. I mean, it dominates.
And they haven't been able to crack the South African electorate. I mean, you know, we have a political party that has been the official opposition for more than 20 plus years. When you have the leading majority party have its fall from grace, go below 50, and your vote share stays exactly the same. The DA is in government today not because of the DA's successes, but because of the ANC's failures. The DA has lost almost 600,000 votes over the last decade. The most votes they ever got was in 2014 and was under Helen Zille. But the DA isn't doing well as a political party. When we look at the numbers, their vote share might stay relatively the same. And, you know, there's almost this common argument that voter turnout in South Africa has decreased, hence why the DA voting share has decreased. But that's not true. We've seen the rise of other breakaway parties, Action SA, the Patriotic Alliance, who have taken on the DA's vote share. And I think that 2024, as much as it was a referendum on the ANC, it was also a wake-up call for the DA to say, you know, we have positioned ourselves as the official opposition for more than 20 plus years. We have made the supposed alternative choice to South Africans, and they still didn't pick you.
Yeah.
And I think that is the real wake-up call, specifically that Jordan Hollywood needs to deal with now, post-John Steenhuisen and the John Steenhuisen era, is that they don't appeal to majority of South Africans, and there isn't actually a political party who does. Mm.
And we don't have to delve in it too deeply, because I want everyone listening to go out and get your book and read it, because you did go into detail on all of the things we're discussing. But the one thing you highlight is the fact that the parties that did well, or the parties that have kind of broken through the clutter, albeit with limited resources, resonated emotionally with blocks of voters. And I wanted to kind of delve into that. And we're also talking about populism and the rise of populism. It's something that's global, but we're seeing it here now. Why do you think communities are resonating with people like Gertin McKenzie of the PA, or Action SA and Herman Mashaba's kind of emotive kind of campaigning?
You know, the fragmented political landscape we have now is a direct response to ANC dominance. Mm. And for many South Africans, like, I mean, if you had to go and get out to South Africans in the street, you'd ask them, what is the biggest issue you're facing in your town? They will tell you one of two things. It will be crime, and it will be the economy.
Yeah.
South Africans are dealing with high unemployment, with economic stagnation, with crime being sky high, gender-based violence being a national crisis. And the government hasn't found a way to address those core issues.
Yeah.
You know, it's bread and butter politics, I like to say. And because they haven't been able to address those core issues, we see the rise of figures like McKenzie, who really preyed on the vulnerability of the colored population. and has made many sectors of the colored population feel like, you know what, they are being specifically marginalized in modern day South Africa. You know, it's a very common saying in the colored community that they weren't white enough to receive the privilege of apartheid, not black enough to receive the privilege of democracy. But when you look at the facts, colored South Africans aren't being marginalized disproportionately to the rest of the South African population. Everyone deals with crime. Everyone deals with unemployment. A similar argument could be made for the Freedom Front Plus, could also be made for AfriForum, where they have really been able to prey on the white farmer population. And farmers will tell you, we are the most disenfranchised in South Africa. We face the most violence. People in the Cape Flats will tell you that equally as well. People in various townships of South Africa will tell you that as well. South Africans are all dealing with these issues.
Yeah.
But because the government hasn't found a broad strategy to be able to address it, we see the rise of populist politicians who come in, like Coleman Mashaba, who says, you know, the reason unemployment is so high is because the immigrants are taking your jobs, when immigrants make up like 2% of the South African population. And that is why we see the rise of populist politicians, is because the government is not addressing these keen issues. And when we look at 2024 specifically, I mean, getting the Kens and the Patriotic Alliance is probably the biggest winner out of 2024 when we look at their dramatic growth. And that is because for many colored South Africans, it's this disproportionality factor in Cape Town and in the Western Cape, where they did overwhelmingly well, is that in the Western Cape and in the city of Cape Town, colored South Africans are about 40% roughly in the city and about 47% in the province. That is not the reality for the rest of the country. They're only about 7% nationally when you look at the demographics of South Africa. And so colored South Africans will tell you that they feel like they are minorities in their own city, in their own province. But we live in a majority black country. And that is something that many colored South Africans struggle with, is that we look, the government is largely black because the country is majority and largely black. And so colored South Africans use this ideal that a small minority of black South Africans have been able to move up the socioeconomic ladder, when the reality is the majority of black South Africans in the exact same position they were before 1994, like the majority of colored South Africans. And so it's almost using these tactics to prey on these vulnerable communities, because everyone thinks that their struggles are the most important. Everyone thinks that they are experiencing something that no one else is experiencing. And that is why these politicians rather have been able to capitalize on that and turn that profitability into votes.
And it's amazing how they've been able to sustain it. I mean, you look at someone like the Freedom Front Plus, who have managed to, although they haven't grown dramatically, they've managed to hold on to their constituency quite consistently over the years. Now, the coalition politics is a very interesting area where entering into, because it changes people's relationships with their political parties. And you'll often hear people say that a vote for X is a vote for the ANC and a vote for Y is a vote for the DA. And then suddenly you have these coalitions either at a local level, a provincial level, or a national level. And people feel like they've sold out or that their votes no longer matter. And Good was a fascinating example of that for me, because Patricia de Lille joined the cabinet previously. And then we saw her numbers kind of just plunge into free fall because she was no longer distinctive. Do you think that that is going to change the game and how people perceive their political homes going forward?
I do think that that perception has already started shifting with the GNU. And political parties face a very difficult. I mean, you know, the DA is a very good example of this currently, foot and mouth disease. It's out of my mind now because I'm writing all about it. The state's policy is that vaccine should only be procured by the state. That is also, in effect, an ANC policy, a historic ANC policy. The DA's policy on paper is that both the state and the private sector should be able to procure vaccines. That is not currently the policy being implemented. So John Steenhuisen now, as the DA minister, is going to court to defend the state-only ANC procurement policy, while the farmers, who are naturally DA voters, and are coming forward and saying, but this is the DA's policy. Why are you not fighting for the DA's policy? And that's the difficulty of the GNU, is that political parties now have to all adopt and implement ANC policies, historic ANC policies. And how do you carve out your own political identity in a governing position when you're implementing another political party's policies? And that is where the lines are slowly starting to get blurred. And I think this will dramatically change how people vote in 2029, because what they're looking for is distinctiveness.
Absolutely.
How are you able to stay true to your values while being able to still being in a governing coalition? A party that's doing this well is the Freedom Front Bus. Peter Groenewald, the former leader, is a minister inside the cabinet. He's the Minister of Correctional Services. But the leader of the party is Corne Mulder, who is still able to get up in parliament and give speeches condemning the ANC while the Freedom Front Plus is still inside the GNU. And so it's really about being able to strike that perfect balance, because how do you bite the hand that feeds you?
And it's fascinating that you bring up the Freedom Front Plus, who've kind of split those kind of responsibilities and are kind of thinking about the next generation. But Justice Malala, he always refers to them as the rats and mice, these little parties that come along, these one-man bands, often with a big figure. We saw it with kind of Rise and Bosa, and even Good to a degree. And how do those parties kind of grow their bases? They are, if they're involved in coalitions, was at such a limited level, and it's very difficult to stand out of the crowd. How do they mobilize and build structures? Because that's really been the reason that they've disappointed, regardless of how much PR they've managed to garner.
Right now, the answer is populism. It is about having the political party be centered around one individual politician. And I mean, you know, we look at the Patriotic Alliance and we look at the Good Party, while both of them are centered around Patricia Dolittle and Gayton McKenzie respectively, is that the way in which they are organized on the ground. I mean, Gayton McKenzie is out in communities every single day and getting people to volunteer for the Patriotic Alliance and encouraging them to vote. Patricia Dolittle is not doing the same thing. And so it's about using that politician's popularity and political identity to mobilize on the ground, because ground mobilization is still the most effective way to get votes. And I think that's the difficulty and something that the Rise and Zanzi's Action Essays and Baldwin's South Africa's did wrong in the last election, is that they did not have that ground mobilization effort. I mean, Songezo Zibi is a very interesting politician. And when I look at Rise and Zanzi's performance in 2024, it was very, very poor. When we look at the amount of money that they received, I mean, his face was on every single poster in the CVDs across the country. And the reason why Rise did so poorly is because Songezo, and we've seen this now in Parliament, I mean, he is very knowledgeable. He's one of the most knowledgeable MPs currently, arguably one of the most knowledgeable chairmen of committees currently. Yeah. I mean, he chairs SCOPA, the most important committee, and that's a very difficult job. But we know very little about Songezo Zibi in his life. People don't know anything about him. And the difficulty is, I mean, he, I make this analogy often, is that he's very much a Thabo Mbeki-era politician. He would do amazing.
The intellectual.
Yes. And like, he's really thoughtful, you know, someone who comes from the private sector, has a love for the country and has now gone into politics. That doesn't work. You know, the politicians that do well today are the Gayton McKenzies, are the Herman Mashabas, are those big personality politicians who are able to get people to rally around a specific idea.
And resonates emotionally, because that's what it is about. The last question I wanted to ask you about coalition politics was the fact that some people believe that you're ignoring the desire of the electorate. So you look at KZN, for example, where MK arguably just missed getting a majority and running that province, and then everyone kind of bands together to keep them out. What do you think the implications of that are over the long term?
So MK is a very unique example. Like, there are very few politicians who could go out on their own, start a new political party mere months before the election and do as well as Ike did. Thabo Mbeki couldn't do it. I don't even think Helen Zille could do what Jacob Zuma did. And so, and I make this analogy in the book, is that I call MK a mirror ball. You know, and they were new, they were shiny, and they had nothing to stand on. And so people were able to project their own ideals of what they believed MK as a political party to be onto MK. And it was just shown back at them because they had nothing to compare it to. And so I think MK's 2024 election performance is something that is very much a misnomer. It is an outlier by a long shot. But this idea of the doomsday coalition that was really popularized by the Moonshot Pact and by the DA, I mean, I talk about this in the book, but it's like, I don't think the doomsday coalition was ever a reality for South Africa. I mean, Cyril Ramaphosa is, if nothing else, one of the most talented and skilled negotiators ever in South African history. I mean, did we really expect someone who sat through CODESA to go into coalition?
It wouldn't have worked.
But it wouldn't work. It wasn't something that was going to happen. Mandy Wien also wrote a very good book about this, about the actual deal of the GNU. And Cyril Ramaphosa played the DA like a fiddle. He was so tired. I mean, he ran the clock out. He waited until the very last minute for something to happen. And I think this idea of a perceived doomsday coalition, I mean, even if we look post the Ramaphosa era, I mean, the EFF burned Paul Mashatile in Gauteng. He's never going to get into bed and into governance with the EFF. MK, getting into a coalition with MK would just be a reunification of the ANC. And that's also something that's not going to happen. The comrades inside the ANC wouldn't allow it. The DA was the only option in 2024. And I think the difficulty is that the DA had spent so many years in opposition, they couldn't see themselves in governance. And they were so desperate to get into government that, I mean, they really did settle for the shortening of the stick. They should have at least 10 ministers if we look at proportionality composition inside the GNU. And the ANC, if nothing else, was able to win the coalition and was able to win the configuration of the post-election power negotiation. And that is the biggest takeaway from 2024, is that while no party is able to achieve 50+1 anymore, it's really about who is able to negotiate power.
I'm going to ask you the question that all political analysts hate facing, but it's your own fault because you called your book Where To From Here. So it implies that we are at some kind of a crossroads and there are different avenues that we could go. Can you give me a big overview of the different scenarios you can predict potentially playing out after the November local government elections?
So I do think that a cabinet reshuffle is on the horizon.
Okay.
There are far too many scandals currently. I mean, Minister Tolashe, the president also doesn't know what to do with Zinzin Mpunu. Like, there are many questions President Ramaphosa needs to answer for. But also Dronia Lewis. He has now come in as the new leader of the DA. My very controversial opinion, which I'm getting dragged on social media for, is I don't think Dronia Lewis will stay the mayor of Cape Town. He has said from the beginning that he would like to stay as the mayor of Cape Town. He does not want to enter cabinet. And I don't think that is going to materialize as well as you think it is going to. The DA is facing a massive challenge with the upcoming local government elections, specifically with the Patriotic Alliance. They only have a 56% majority. 6% between Action SA, the PA, and the Freedom Front Plus is not a lot. It is not a lot to bring the DA below 50.
Yeah.
And I think Julian Lewis is currently the most front-facing Cape Town politician that the DA has. And to pick anyone else as close to the election, they just do not have the time to be able to put someone else on the same page as if they have Jordan. So my controversial opinion is that I think he will stay. He will be the mayor. He will get the budget passed and then he will leave. Because how do you as the mayor of Cape Town tell the president what to do? When you are supposed to be equal governing coalition partners, it brings in a very difficult dynamic.
It's very complex. It's a complex environment.
Complex. Yeah. And how do you manage the city, manage the party, and manage the GNU? Those are too many different moving parts. More specifically, I mean, if you are the mayor of Cape Town, you are geographically locked into a location. How are you going to campaign in Limpopo and then the taxi industry in Cape Town decides to go on strike?
Like, exactly.
There are too many of those misnomers and issues that Jordan Lewis will have to deal with. So that is my controversial opinion on what is going to happen with the DA. But when we look broadly electorally, I think that the upcoming local government elections is going to be about horse trading. It is not going to be about one metro specifically. Joburg is all anyone can talk about now and who will be the mayor of Joburg. I also controversially think it will not be Helen Zille. While she will get the most votes, I mean, Action SA, the ANC and EFF are currently in coalition in Tshwane. They are also the coalition in the Government of Provincial Unity. That will massively affect how Ekurhuleni and the city of Joburg goes. When we look at what is going to happen in Cape Town, when we look at Itakwini, it is about horse trading across the metros. And that is what is going to define the 2026 local government elections. It is negotiating. And that is really what is going to define elections going forward. It is about how people can seize power through negotiating rather than how they seize it through the electorate. Because until the South African electorate becomes more engaged, it is only ever going to be coalitions and it is only ever going to be power through negotiation.
And I cannot believe that we got through this entire discussion. So one of my favorite parts of your book is where you talk about the winners, the losers, and losers as you reflect on the previous election. And the IFP, whatever it is, nobody saw them kind of quietly build their success and build on the existing structures. They're a good blueprint for an existing party that's managed to kind of pivot with the times. What do you think has led to their success?
The IFP has done what COPE was not able to do.
Yeah.
And that is campaign on the ground. And that is really where and how you capture the votes of everyday South Africans is you have volunteers on the ground every single day knocking on doors. And that's what they've really been able to do in KZN and really been able to do nationally is that you have many disengaged ANC voters that no one has been able to capitalize on. The ANC and the IFP in terms of policy positions on paper are very similar. And the difference is that the IFP has good governance and coalition history, whereas the ANC and various other political parties do not. And so the IFP has really been able to stand on a leg of good faith to say to South African voters, you like the policies of the ANC. They're not being implemented as you believe they should be. Give us a chance. And they have such good ground mobilization. And that is really the key, is that they have the ground mobilization of the DA without the polarizing policies of the DA. And that is why the IFP has really been able to do well. And I think that the IFP, the Freedom Front Plus, and Patriotic Alliance will be the biggest winners of the upcoming local government election because they are able to mobilize on the ground as well as they do.
Campaigning is so important, and just old school politics, yeah. I think that's going to become important as we look ahead. Now, before we wrap things up, the one thing that I marvel about as I read the book is the extent of your political knowledge, the simplicity of the arguments that you make and explanations that you offer. I think it's such a comprehensive book. So you obviously looked up to a lot of people on the way as you were listening to Cave Talk and being quizzed. Who are some of the political analysts you look up to and the political writers you really enjoy?
I like to say that I grew up in the gold age of talk radio. So my big thing in talk radio has always been John Matham, who the book is dedicated to. I love John so much. Like, I could talk about John Matham.
You can't beat his general knowledge.
You cannot. I own the rapid fire book, actually. And like, I can count on one hand how many times he's gotten a question wrong. So it was John Matham, it was Rafael Malotto, and it was Eusebius McKaiser. I remember listening to them on radio every single day. Like in high school, I grew up in the age where we could listen to music while doing our work in class, and I would listen to talk radio. That's how invested I was. And then I grew up reading so many books. I mean, I grew up on Peter Bruce. Mm-hmm. I grew up on Peter Dutour and Ferial Haffajee. Mm-hmm. I soaked in so much political knowledge. I remember reading The President's Keeper when I was like 15, 16, and like that book changed my life. And I was like, I did not know this was happening in the country. And it was that political realizations I had when I was so much younger that really shaped me in who I am today. It also made me realize that people really don't know the inner workings of politics and what really happened in South Africa. And that's what I really try to do in the book, is to break things down as simple as possible and really make people understand that politics isn't as complex as you think it is.
I think it is a fantastic book. I really enjoyed reading it. I think whether you are deeply engaged in politics or whether you just kind of watch it from the periphery, I think there are lots of insights and lots of lessons and learnings and thoughts that can get you going. So I do think it's mandatory reading ahead of this year's local government elections. And we often talk about the lack of civic education and voter education in South Africa. And I think this is probably the latest ultimate guide for it. Unfortunately, we do have to leave it there. But I must encourage everyone listening, Where To From Here by Tara Roos is available where all good books are sold. And it is fundamental reading for South African voters. Until next time, I'm Twanja Kalula. Thank you for listening to PageCast.